everybody, and welcome back to another episode of What's in the Box. We're talking about what we're playing in Cube and what you should try out in yours. I'm one of your hosts, Drew, or Quad Nines, and here with my other co-host is Zakil.
What's up, everyone? Today we have a very special guest. He is one of our own from the MTG YouTube community, an excellent content producer, a director, which we'll get to in a little bit later, and, you know, an excellent asset and one of the most creative people I've ever met in my entire life. The Magic Man, Sam.
Thank you so much, Zakil. I'm stoked to be with you guys. I'm excited especially to talk about Cube because I think it's something that has always been in my Magic life, but I've never actually touched on much myself. So needless to say, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, this will be a super interesting conversation. I know that you said that you were interested in possibly building a Cube within the next year, so I'll definitely have some questions for you about that. But to start everything off, and get a quick background. Where are you from? What brought you to Magic? What was the first time playing Magic? And so on and so forth. Give our listeners a background as to, you know, who you are.
Yeah. So I grew up in El Paso. I was born and raised in El Paso, Texas, which is a border town squished between New Mexico and Mexico. And it's one heck of a place to grow up. I don't think there's anything like it anywhere else. But I moved away from El Paso when I was 14 to Colorado, and I went to high school and college there. And now I'm back in Austin, Texas, on the other side of the huge old state that is Texas. And I'm going to grad school at UT. So hook 'em horns, I guess. Yeah. So that's where I'm from in a nutshell. What brought me back to Magic was actually my cousin. My cousin has been one of those folks you look up to your whole life. And he's the one who got me into gaming. He's the one who's always just inspired me to explore games in general. And he was really, really into Magic. He's still into Magic. He's a PTQ grinder out in California at the moment. But very early on, when I was very impressionable, you know, like a middle schooler looking for his identity and his place in the world, my cousin Kyle was always there to point me in a good direction towards games and whatnot. So he brought me into Magic. So the first time I played was like when I was 12, 13, but he lives in Virginia. So my summers were spent with him. When I went back to Texas, I didn't have anybody to play with. So Magic was always this thing I really wanted to get into, but I never could because it does require at least one other person that lives close. Mm-hmm. So Magic was always just like on the back burner and kind of in the background of all these other nerdy aspects of my life that I was exploring, like video games, which are way more accessible if you don't have like a big crowd of people that are interested in the same stuff you are. And it wasn't until college where I was able to finally get into like a local game store and get back to that card game that caught my eye when I was, like I said, young. And then I guess the rest is history from there. So, nice. So that's kind of when I started playing, although it's a bit of an asterisk. Like I didn't really play until, like I said, I guess it was the summer of 2012.
Okay. Sweet. Quickly going back, what kind of games did you play just out of curiosity? Were you more of like an MMORPG kind of guy, computer, console? No, just curious.
Yeah. So it did start on console. The first time I went out to Virginia with Kyle, those were the N64 days. And, I remember like having to sneak money, by my grandfather who took me out to Virginia to visit Kyle. So I could buy Tony Hawk Pro Skater 8 or Tony Hawk Pro Skater on N64, you know, the blue cartridge. And so it started there. And then the next time I went out, Kyle was super into EverQuest, and EverQuest was finally the thing that I could do while I was at home that could like, that I could play with Kyle. Cause it was online, of course. So yeah, it was EQ that brought me to sort of like fantasy, just fantasy gaming. And I spent a lot of time in middle school on EverQuest. Like, if you want to talk about the nostalgia train, that for me is the heart of all things, I think, you know? So it started with EverQuest, and then life got busy and I never went back to any MMOs or anything, but I don't think anything can replace EverQuest at this point too, so not even Magic, like.
No, yeah, I feel it for sure. I had very similar experiences. My favorite game of all time is Ocarina of Time, Zelda Ocarina of Time.
Yeah, okay.
And a bunch of the original Final Fantasies, and like even now I have a whole bunch of altars hoping to get commissioned just so I can think back and you know, play some of those old games as I'm playing Magic, or just like relive those memories. I definitely understand what you're saying.
Yep, yep. I think everybody has a game or a couple of games that just take you home. So EverQuest is mine. Magic is a close second now, but nothing beats the OG, you know.
Mm-hmm. So I was had an emulator recently, and it would do anything from old classic Nintendo to Super Nintendo to N64. And nothing is worse than going back and playing the game and be like, is this what it was like? Anything better?
So. You're right. You're so right. What I do like about EverQuest still now thinking about it is that it was never the graphics, because the graphics were never that good. You know, it's really killer when a gameplay can just outlive its graphics.
Which you think would make Magic Online better, but not so much.
Touche.
The last thing you just said reminded me, I played RuneScape for like 2 or 3 years, and every time I tell people, they're just like, how could you play that terrible game?
Dude, yep. Yeah, exactly. Good times, but...
Anyway, the Magic Man Sam. So you have a YouTube channel. You said you started in about 2012. Was that the same time that you started up your YouTube channel?
No, the YouTube channel came a year after. So I found Magic again with my buddy Spencer. It was the end of summer 2012, like between the lull of my summer job and going back to school. We had like a month of just, what are we going to do all day? You know, and we were driving around. I was jokingly saying like, we should go get some Pokemon cards just to ride the nostalgia train again. But when we got there, I was like, actually, Spence, we need to try this game Magic again. So we bought a couple of M13 core set, just intro pack. I think he bought the Audric one and I bought the Talrand one.
Nice.
And we started playing, and one of his buddies that he was working with was like our Magic guru, who introduced us to actually the person that, that owns a cube, which is what I actually learned Magic on. So yeah, it was like a series. It was a series of people that helped me get into Magic. And then the YouTube channel came a year after, when I decided to like essentially combine all of my interests, both like the financial side and the creative side, which YouTube provides. So yeah, it took a little while. It would be super awkward to like do both at the same time, because I didn't know if Magic was going to stick. I didn't know I was going to get into it. But once I decided that it was going to stick around, then I wanted to find ways to, make the game cheaper, but also provide an outlet for my creativity.
Sure.
And I think YouTube does both just really well. So.
Of course. So the YouTube channel comes, Magic Man Sam makes an appearance on the internet. And the reason I say this is because I specifically remember the day. I still remember the day that this happened, as I think I saw it the day after the original upload, but all these people were like going crazy, like, oh my gosh, there's this new channel that's coming up. And I remember you had done a trailer of some kind, kind of like a channel introduction, and it went through, you know, all these crazy cinematic things. I remember this specific scene where you have like a goblin grenade, and I think it explodes. Wait, no. It goes, so you cast it and like it appears in a different scene.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so it was the drawing of Goblin Grenade that gets transposed into the card art. So like I drew Goblin Grenade, and then just with like some savvy editing, it was like morphed into the card art, and then that zooms out and I'm holding 4 goblin grenades and I'm casting them on my enemy. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's that.
I remember that, and it was because at the time you have to, like, a lot of people don't know this, but at the time mostly, you know, most YouTube channels were either just unboxing or trade confirmations, and then there was an occasional like creative stuff like, hey, look at my EDH deck with some small visual effects. But when I saw this, I was like, you know, mine just, holy cow. So I've definitely been a fan ever since then. And of course, later on, you produced a movie, you know, a movie on YouTube called The Modern Master, in which it is the ultimate box opening experience, if I would say, if I was to describe it. You go through and there's a story around this box of Magic cards, and I don't want to spoil anything, but, you know, it definitely takes you through a journey, and I remember you had teased the spoilers teased the episodes out for about a month and a half, maybe 2 months, and then finally released it on Christmas Day, I believe 2 years ago. And, you know, it's an excellent film. So how did the idea of that come to fruition, just out of curiosity?
Yeah, so The Modern Master was exactly what you said. I was doing a series at the same time called Cantrips, which was basically a play on the magic. It's not really a mechanic, but, you know, it's magic lingo. Mm-hmm. And that series was basically me going out and opening up a pack of magic cards at maybe the worst timing that you could imagine, you know, like going out in public, opening packs on airplanes, opening packs in front of, you know, like the Alamo, these kinds of places. And that was pretty fun, and pretty goofy, but that's basically what inspired The Modern Master. 'Cause I had the click when Modern Masters, the original, product came out, that there were 24 packs in the box, which is unusual because typically there's 36 in a magic booster box. Mm-hmm. Am I right with that? 36?
Yeah.
Sure. And of course I thought 24. Well, what else has 24 in it? Oh, hours in a day. And the original thought for The Modern Master was I do a pack opening for each hour, and it would be similar to Cantrips, where like I would either write a skit that pertained to the hour of the day. So, so like the first couple episodes of The Modern Master were with that in mind. So the first one is called One Drops, and I was making a bunch of, I don't know, puns or I was just playing with the idea of one at the hour of one. So, you know, at 1 o'clock, I talk about all the one drops that are in Modern Masters. At 2 o'clock, I'll do a weird skit with two or, you know, whatever. So that's what it started with. And then it like quickly, decided to take a route and sort of ask the question, what happens if magic happened in real life? What happens if I get this box from some random person and this box starts to interact with my real life? And from there, I found Corey Huber, who ended up being like, in reality, the guy who was working a lot more than I was behind the scenes in terms of making sure the project was finished, making sure the engines kept rolling and that the script was good and that we filmed on time. And financially, he provided the box. He provided like the money to make the project. So he was very much accredited. I was in front of the camera, but he was doing all the hard stuff. So he kept me motivated. And it was like essentially the ultimate cantrip episode. And again, it just mirrored my desire and my need to be creative, and also make sure that the hobby stayed inexpensive. So I don't know. It was a blast to do. And he was also the guy that finally got at the end a visual effects dude to come in and just polish it up and make sure it looked really, really cool. And yeah, that was The Modern Master. I haven't watched it since, because when, for me, a project that big, like, the point of making the project is to do it. And then once the product is finished, then it's out of my system. And so I feel like it's a cathartic release and I don't need anything to do with it anymore. And, sure. And so for me, I think if I watched it again, I'll just laugh, you know?
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, that was a blast, man. That took a lot out of me, but it was definitely one of my favorite things. And I'm just super stoked that you still remember it and that you still care about it, because that means it was effective in some way, you know.
Oh, yeah, it's a classic. MTG YouTube classic, I think.
You say had a cue. That's how you really got into it. Was it like, is that all y'all really played, or was it a certain kind of cube that got your attention?
Yeah. So like I said, I started with M13, and I was learning the game simultaneously through the intro deck, but also going to FNM and just drafting a lot of M13, which was a really good core set to draft, not only to learn the game, but also just, I think it's an effect. I think it's fun. I think if you have any access to M13 draft, you should try it. And at the same time, I was learning how to draft, Kirk and Jan are two different people. They own a cube that's like a modern / legacy cube. And they were teaching Spencer and I, the newbies, like basically how to play magic through the cube. And so we would have, just guys night where we'd buy some beer and draft the cube with like four or six people ideally. And that's, I was introduced to cube and EDH at the same time that I was being introduced to magic. So just like a massive, just huge amount of visual and like, card information and history. It was basically like I was thrown into the pit of magic you know, 0 to 1,000 right away, which was my kind of style, I guess, to learn the game, but also to be able to play with friends, you know.
Yeah, you seem to pick up a lot more interactions a little faster when you're playing, you know, big EDH games because there's so many different cards you haven't seen or cube because, you know, a lot of the cards that when they're printed, they had no idea that this other card was being printed 10 years later and has this neat interaction. So, yeah, I understand what you're talking about there. It definitely gets your learning curve up a lot.
Yeah, you end up just reading a ton of cards and having to memorize on the fly. Which is what I like about drafting, but also cube specifically, because it teaches you so many things about Magic at the same time, because you have to craft a deck. You have to be intentional about what you're picking. But you're also thinking about, I don't know, all these powerful cards that you've heard, maybe because you watched a Pro Tour or something, or you've read a couple of forums and suddenly you have a choice between Snapcaster Mage and Karn Liberated. And you have to weigh out the options between these super powerful cards because, you know, arguably they are two very different cards, albeit both powerful. And I don't know, it's like, it's a really unique way to learn, but I think it's super rewarding because on the flip side, you end up crafting this deck that is really powerful and you get to play with these kick-ass spells. I guess obviously with the cube that I was drafting, that was my experience. We weren't drafting Pauper or anything, so I was spoiled from the get-go to just play with like Magic's best cards, you know.
Was there any certain play, like when you first got started, you're like, what? Like, what just happened there? Like, how did that work?
Yeah. I have distinct memories of losing a lot to Jan. Jan is probably arguably the best player in the playgroup. And so anytime I was pitted against Jan, like, he would always show me all of those really, really subtle interactions. Jan's the kind of player that, like, when he has, like, a Mycosynth Wellspring on the battlefield, your eyebrows are raised. You're thinking, like, what is Jan going to do with that? You know, it's like a very unconspicuous card, but when Jan's playing, there has to be something else going on there. Or he'll have, like, a Darksteel Myrrh, which is literally for 3 mana, a 0/1 indestructible Myrrh, you know? But that'll raise your eyebrow. It's like, why did he choose to include that in his deck? So I have a lot of, again, I have a lot of really specific memories losing to Jan, which were also, of course, at the same time, very instructional to learn how to play. But there's one specific memory that I have beating Jan. I drafted like a Bant Flicker deck, basically. It was running Flicker Wisp and Venser the Sojourner, the Planeswalker. And at the same time, it was running cards like Moldrifter and Thragtusk. So one of his archetypes in his cube is obviously Flicker, and I've literally probably beat Jan maybe 5 times, and that was one of the decks that I ever beat him with. And something so satisfying about drawing 2 cards and like getting a beast token and gaining 5 life and just being able to do that over and over and over again in a deck is just super, super value. So yeah, anytime I see Venser or like Thragtusk pop up anywhere, I just think back to that. But also, I mean, the better memories are obviously like getting together with friends, having pizza, having beer, and like bullshitting and just having a blast together. And that was kind of, that was like my last memory with those dudes, before I left. We had a few nights where we just did that. And, you know, that's obviously why I play Magic. So I think Cube lends itself to that kind of environment just really well.
Yeah, it definitely does. Some of my favorite Cube memories are like just the same thing you said, everyone hanging around, having a beer, just relaxing, having fun. And then usually in my play group, it ends up being where there's like one match left because everybody's done and everyone's like screaming at the two players to do a play and like, no, don't, no.
Yep.
That is, yeah, it's, every time something like that happens, that's always what happens. But anyway, I saw recently on Twitter that you expressed, you know, one of your New Year's resolutions was possibly to build a cube.
Yes. Yeah. This is a big project that I want to do. Basically because I moved to Austin and within a month I found a really solid EDH playgroup and we've just been playing a ton of EDH. And a bunch of other games actually. They're big time gamers. So that's really sweet. And now is just the time to like, not only in my Magic career, but also just to spice things up from week to week. We get together every Saturday and we play. So I just thought it would be a perfect project to like, you know, synthesize all of our interests and put some cards together and hopefully make a really kick-ass cube that we can draft together. So yeah, that's in the works.
Is it, do you have anything picked out, like what you want it to be like? It doesn't sound like you're going to go pauper since you've had the taste of the, modern / legacy card pool. So
you're right. No, I've had the juiciest of spells. I don't know if I could play pauper. I mean, I could, I absolutely would, but if I'm going to invest some time and money into a cube, I think I'm going to go for the big stuff. You're right.
Nice. And then have you put any thought into like specific design parameters? I know you had just said you want to go into the big stuff, but have you ever, just out of curiosity, have you ever played a thematic cube? Like, I think a lot of times people are, that's not necessarily like, hold on, my thought train is like all over the damn place. pardon me. Have you put any thought into specific archetypes with that? So for example, the Magic Online cube often differs from many of the common cubes because a lot of people feel as though aggro isn't represented very well in the Magic Online cube. But do you want cube to be more just an environment where... Sorry, how do I say this? This is like, I have so many things to say, but I don't know how to say this. Because the way... I'm trying to say, the way that I view cube is that... Yeah, I don't know.
are you going for like a bunch like paper rock scissors decks or a bunch of different scissors?
I like that. Okay.
You know what I mean? Like this beats this and this beats this, or there's all these things that just kind of get in there and go at it.
Yeah, I guess the biggest question is what is a theme to you versus an archetype?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was good. Sorry.
No, I mean, how would you answer that? What is a theme versus an archetype? Is that two different things? Because I'm unfamiliar with both of them. So I mean, obviously, I know what an archetype is, but
I believe so. When I think of a cube that some kind of thematic cube, I would think of something like tribal, something like pauper, something like a colorless artifact only cube. And when I think
or
of
a combo cube, even
yeah, or a combo cube or something where there's obviously some specific themes. So we're not going to be looking at this the same way we'd be looking at a traditional legacy cube like we would the Magic Online cube or a powered cube or a pauper cube, because the goal of this isn't necessarily to draft to win, but as much as to experience the theme that the cube designer has set.
Ah, cool. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'd probably end up going towards the archetype side more than like a thematic cube. Maybe because, again, I just come from the modern legacy type atmosphere, and so I'd like to recreate that in some way and have like three or four different archetypes within the cube, but not necessarily limited to just pauper or peasant or whatever. So yeah, just because I want to play really good cards, you know?
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so like, floating around in my mind, just based on my collection, but also my experience, I think it'd be fun to have, you know, aggro established pretty well, soldiers being like, I don't know if you can do this. Again, I've never built a cube, but in my mind currently, I see aggro and soldiers being a thing together.
Yeah.
I don't know if, you know.
Yeah. Field Marshal could be a number one pick.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I actually have Field Marshal, so that's good to hear. And at the same time, you can have, like, we have a player in my EDH group who loves Eldrazi, and so I'd like to throw, like, a ramp theme in the cube that also provides, big creatures to ramp into. So I think those two archetypes are really different from each other and creates variance within the cube. But I got a bunch of notes from Jan who has been like very diligent about maintaining his cube, updating his cube. He's pretty obsessed with it, and he's always talking about it, and he's always checking Cube Tutor and, you know, comparing. He actually has us write deck lists down every time he drafts a cube so that he could keep track statistically of how many cards are, you know, which cards are drafted most often, what the archetypes look like. So he's super into it, and he told me similar things. You know, you want cards that can incentivize you to go into a certain archetype, you know, I guess a card like Mer Battlesphere, or I guess Mer Battlesphere is a little more applicable to other archetypes, but that's a good card as an example because he likes it when a card makes you go into an archetype but can also serve other functions in other decks. So like the control deck can draft Mer Battlesphere, and that can be a good finisher for their strategy. You know, that's the card that they're finally going to win the game with. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the dude who's drafting artifacts really wants that card because it works really well with his early game or his mid game or whatever.
Absolutely.
So that's basically like where I'm coming from right now. It's like a merge of my collection, but also my EDH playgroup's interests, and also the deck builder inside me. I basically get to build a deck that's 360 cards. You know, that's sweet, and they're all and they're all one ofs. You know.
Go ahead.
So have you had a chance to play any of the iterations of the Magic Online Cube?
No, I'm on a Mac. I know. The collective groan of everybody. I mean, obviously I get to watch a lot of Magic content, but I actually haven't seen the Mythgo Cube at all, so I'd love to hear about it.
Well, there's been a couple, like I said, a couple different versions of it recently. You said you're usually, like with the EDH playgroup, they actually had a legendary cube, which actually tends to lean a little bit more towards the big splashy EDH style play, and not like there's not as much like just aggro kill you on turn four, I guess.
Okay, but, cool.
That's something you might check out. But then, of course, they also have what they call their legacy cube, which means it's got to be legacy legal. So it takes out power and, you know, mind twist, stuff like that. But, yeah, there's definitely a couple different ways to go. I've always liked the vintage cube or the powered cube that they have, just cause I don't like doing really broken things. But, yeah, like, would you say you're leaning more towards the EDH style? Like, they kind of limited themselves to only legendary creatures, and that's a little bit too much of a limiting factor for me to ever try and build one of those, but they gave it a shot, I suppose.
Yeah. How does it play out? Because I've watched a couple of draft videos. It seems like I imagine that like 4 and 5 color is supported pretty well, just mana fixing wise.
I don't know if it's supported pretty well. I think it just ends up being that.
It's just forced. Okay.
Everybody winds up drafting 5-color good stuff, and it's like, if you draw your ramp and your spells in the right order, I cast my Haymaker, and then, oh, you can't kill it. Well, I guess I win.
Yeah, and, I see. Okay.
But it was okay in small doses, but I definitely would like to see somebody give it a shot without the exact constraints they put on it. But because, you know, I enjoy EDH a lot, actually, and just some of the spells that probably aren't good enough for your best of cubes, or it's just the strongest version of whatever.
Right.
But yeah, it's definitely something to think about for it design wise. But on another point, best thing about the Magic Online Cube is if you select Swiss, if you go 2/1, you can pretty much just draft infinite. So.
Oh, that's sweet. Okay.
Cause I'm like you, I don't get to, like I occasionally get a group together and we draft 6 or 8 people, but the majority of my, magic and cubing is Magic Online. So it kind of gets me my fix, I guess.
Yeah, totally. Do you have a paper cube?
Yes, I do. I've been working on it since Innistrad block, I guess.
Okay, cool.
It took a little going through.
Yeah, for sure. That seems to be the pattern. Like I've seen many iterations of Jan's cube, and he's always thinking about. It's amazing to think that you could change one card in like a 540 card pool, and that could have a significant like ripple effect towards anything else. Cause he's always thinking about tiny, tiny interactions, and just the fine tuning is what I'm excited to get to, because you have to have like, obviously you have to have a foundation. You have to put a bunch of cards together and play it out 10, 15, 20 times to see which cards work, which cards don't. That's just like with any deck, you know, mm-hmm. but I like to watch and hear about people's cubes evolving over time, and, you know, archetypes being either reinforced or like moved away from altogether. Or maybe you had an idea that like, you know, white red is supposed to be aggro, and then someone drafts like a white red black mid range deck that works better than your aggro plan, you know, because you kind of make this thing in a vacuum, and then you put it out in the real world, and then, you know, people surprise you with how they manage it.
Yeah, I actually have a funny story about that. My first cube build was, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, and I had just taken a list off of MTG Salvation because I was like, I don't know if I really want to do this, so let's just proxy it all up and see, you know, if we have some fun. And the funny thing about that is it wasn't until that I had changed part of my list to fit my playgroup, because we had cards, or pardon me, it wasn't until I had changed my list to fit my playgroup that we started really understanding all the interactions. Because even as someone, even someone as myself who's played Legacy, played Vintage, played EDH, there's so many cards in which, you know, so many aspects of design that is involved in Cube that it's very difficult. So, for example, we had Upheaval, Burning of Zingi, Fires of Yavimaya, and each of those cards are completely different. And the reason I mentioned Fires is because a Fires deck is completely different from a green-red aggro deck. But you would never know that because there, it's not like there's a, you know, a 20-page manual that goes with each kind of cube.
Right. Okay.
Or something like Upheaval, something like Burning of Zingi. When you look at it at face value, it's like, why would I ever want to return all permanents to their owner's hands? Or why would I ever want to make each player sack four lands? Like, that seems terrible. But it isn't until you get, you know, some feedback from this person, or maybe go online and you start to kind of change your environment, that you realize that, okay, the strategies are either really good or maybe this isn't quite what we're looking for. And I can definitely understand what you're saying, that you have to appeal to a couple different players. Like, for example, in my original cube, I had ran Moat, and Moat is a very uninteractive card. And my playgroup slammed me over it. But when you go on MTG Salvation and you go on Reddit, this is supposed to be a cube mainstay. But even though it's a cube mainstay, it's not something that my playgroup really accepts, really wants. So my cube is different in that way because of those. Pardon me if I'm blambling on, but yeah, I hope that made some sense.
No, it did. I thought Drew had something to say too.
Yeah, I was going to say, because just even you talking about some of the little changes that have a ripple effect, it's like, the new colorless mana symbol that came out and the cards that you can only cast with that. Well, like, I've got all 10 signets in my cube because I heavily support artifacts, like, whether it be like Tinker or Wildfire or Upheaval, you know, make a lot of mana, bounce everything, go at it. But like in some cases now you'd rather have talismans over the signets because they can tap for colorless mana, instead of not being able to. So, and still stuff like the pain lands are a little bit better now. So, you know, you really got to take that into account, I think. Also, like, say they print a new, you know, a two-power guy for one, that you really got to pay attention to his creature types, because, like, you know, human soldier is much different than, like, human monk, because, like you said, boy, if you want a sub-soldier theme. But, yeah, it's just a lot of different things that go, like, little things that you don't think will matter. Like, you had this one card, but it has synergies with, like, you know, 10 or 12 cards that you weren't even thinking about when you added it. But, yeah, I've actually, we cubed, when was it? This is Monday we're recording this. We cubed Friday. And I saw even a couple new interactions that I hadn't noticed before. So I'm actually going to go through the entire cube again and just see if I can, you know, improve anything.
Yeah, totally. How often, just out of curiosity, do you guys put a new card if a new set drops, how many cards are you putting into your cube from that set? Does it ever, like, influence you to take out upwards of 10, 15, 20 cards just because you found this new card that you kind of want to push in your cube?
Do you want to go first?
It depends. Like, what was it? Born of the God? Was it Born of the Gods or Journey? Gosh, one of them was just, like, so horrible. Like, there was actually, like, maybe three cards in the entire set that were, like, playable. And, you know, generally my rule is Planeswalkers get a pass. Like, if it's a new Planeswalker, is it all playable, I'm going to try it out to see if it's any good. And, you know, sometimes they get yanked out really quickly. But, yeah, like, generally I just kind of add to start off with, and I kind of, like Usman was talking about the other day, about I just kind of seed them into the packs to make sure they get drafted the first couple of drafts after that.
Okay.
And see how they perform. You know, if they do, then I start looking for cuts. Like, what was the last thing drafted? What really doesn't go as well anymore? And then sometimes if the new cards aren't cutting it, I just pull them instead. But yeah, really just depends on the set. But I probably add anywhere from 4 to as many as like 12 from each different set.
Yeah, and, cool. Okay.
I think it also depends on the size of your cube. The smaller your cube is, the higher the competition is going to be. And additionally, like the power of your environment. So if you have a powered cube that's only 360 cards, it's going to be really unlikely that, you know, the new set has too many things they're going to be able to compete with, you know, I don't know, Liliana of the Veil kind of thing, or like Super or Jitte or Batterskull, just because the card or the power of those cards are so high. But from, I kind of changed my philosophy on this over the past 2 years is because, yes, the environment is fun, and I ran a powered environment, like a really tight powered environment list for a really long time. But at the same time, when new cards come out, you kind of, you know, I want to play them. I want to change up the flavor. I want people to have fun. I want to see new interactions that would never happen. So the funny thing about this is that every couple months, we usually get a new Splinter Twin target, and you would never really imagine it. So like Grey Oak Guardian came out in Commander 2015, as well as Village Bellringer came out in Avacyn Restored, but because the cards aren't, you know, really necessarily as competitive as something like Deceiver Exarch or Zealous Conscripts, you know, your playgroup isn't going to value them as highly. But when you go and you cast Splinter Twin on Village Bellringer or Kiki-Jiki on Grey Oak Guardian, you still get the same effect. So the small things, like you were saying, changing individual cards, they can have huge ramifications because now the Splinter Twin deck is so much more powerful than it was before, because instead of having three targets to go infinite, it has six.
Ah, yeah, sure. Renegade Krasis is also... Yeah. And that's a card that I think that would qualify under Jan's favorite cards, because Renegade Krasis is like a 3-3 with Flash, right?
Mm-hmm. Bounding Krasis?
Bounding Krasis. So that fits the Splinter Twin deck, but even if you don't draft Splinter Twin, like a 3-3, a Flash 3-3 is pretty sweet, you know, if you're just playing the Flash deck or whatever. Three power is different from a 1-4. You know, some archetypes and some drafts want the 3-3 rather than the 1-4, because it's not the vacuum of Modern where the four toughness matters against Lightning Bolts.
Mm-hmm. Or on the flip side, there are times that you would give anything to have Deceiver XR against the mono red deck because they just can't kill it, kind of thing.
Exactly. You're right.
And then again, sometimes you just get to slap a Splinter Twin on an Inferno Titan and make your opponent very sad.
Just go for straight value, not infinite. Just, yeah, eat this many times. Yep, I can dig that too. Now, the other thing is that appeals to the casual side of MTG is that we get to get excited about the, you know, like the inconspicuous cards, which is why I'm also excited to build a cube, because it makes you, you know, like as an EDH player, I'm stoked about the new... one white blue creature from Oath that enters the battlefield and
mage,
that's it. Yeah. Bounces a creature, whatever. Like that goes directly into my Brago deck, and maybe that's not. I mean, it's a pretty decent card. Maybe it sees some standard play or whatever. But you know, you get to view the entire set and the entire game from a different lens. So, you know, the cards that the cube players get stoked about may not have any effect in standard, but it's exactly what your archetype needed, and yeah. I'm excited to join that world, you know?
I cannot agree more. My favorite card of last year was Reclamation Sage. It's an uncommon from M15, but being a 2-1 elf that has... So it costs one green, two colorless for a 2-1 elf that when it enters the battlefield, destroy target, artifact, or enchantment. Most people know what it does. Know what it does, but because... I guess the correct wording, which would be what Usman said last week, is it's just very innocuous. You would never really expect that card, and it just seems like something that's always there. It's just kind of an ideal cube card, and because it wasn't huge, like it's not a Planeswalker, it's not a Mythic, it's not explosive, but it just fills the role that I was looking for the longest time, that is a cube mainstay.
Yeah, that card especially is also exciting in EDH every single time. That's almost an auto-include in all the green decks I build. Especially because you get the sweet like pseudo full art version, which I very much appreciate. You know,
I was actually looking to pick up a playset of those, and I'm like, now I got to make more EDH decks. Oh wait, I'm gonna do that anyway. Great.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. this is a circle of justifications. You know,
it's like I was listening to Brainstorm Brewery, and somebody. Jason Altz used to really bag on EDH, but now he's like an EDH finance guy, you know, really looks at that stuff. And one of the guys said, but yeah, that's just a one of those. It's not like they got a playset. And he goes, I think it's Corbin he's talking to, of course. He's like, Corbin, so do you think that these guys that build EDH decks, do you think when they decide to make another deck, they take their soul ring out of the other deck they had? No, they just get another soul ring and another this and that, and they just build another deck. And all of a sudden they have 12 decks.
Yep. Yeah. That's so true, man. I can't, I can't find myself to, I have like 7 or 8 chromatic lanterns and I'm happy about it, you know?
Sidetrack again, but, speaking of, chrome things, but, I remember the video you had Chromanticore, and this is still one of my favorite videos. Like, we start casting the spells and the guy's like, huh? What?
Yeah, dude, that's my Chromanticore deck tech. That's actually why I have 4 Chromatic Lanterns or 6 or whatever, because I was playing that card for a little bit, because that was before, you know, mana in Standard was perfect. That was when we had to suffer through like temples and whatnot to get our mana fix. So I was playing like, you know, an iteration of the Chromanticore deck with Chromatic Lantern, but hey, I still love Chromanticore. Maybe that's a card that makes it in my cube. Who knows?
You just did talk about the Full Art Reclamation Sage. As many people know, both Drew and I are huge into pimping. Do you have any plans for your cube in terms of pimping?
So pimping is one of my favorite things that you do, Zakiel, because I sit through. I literally wish you just filmed your collection and I'd watch that video endlessly, you know? I'm all about it. It's something I foresee down the road. I'm at this point in my EDH career that I'm also ready to start pimping the decks that have run the gamut. You know, I've played with 30, 40 times, 50 times or whatever, and I like the deck and I like the cards in it, and it's close to being a perfect 99 or whatever, you know?
Yeah, of course.
So I think the first step is obviously just to get the cards in there and play with them before I buy out all the foils, but yeah, Jan's cube is close to 100% foil, and it's just so much fun to hold that much value. Not only you know you get like a foil Huntmaster of the Fells, and in the same hand you have foil Liliana of the Vale, and you know like a foil OG flooded Strand, because he's all about the OG stuff. Oh, yeah. So you know, again, mimicking the finance thing, like I want to be able to play with my collection. I don't want to just sit and look at it. So. A resounding yes is my answer for you. You know, I want to pimp it, you know. Speaking of which, what are your pimpage pickups, both of you, lately?
I'll let Drew go first, actually, because I am still kind of up in the air about what I want to do.
Well, I finally picked up an LED, which there's not, since I want most of my cards to be in English so people can read them. There's not much you can do with the LED other than maybe get it altered. But I was actually picked up a full Snapcaster Mage the other day. And, what else was it? Oh, and got, full All Is Dust, which is going to do double duty between the cube and an EDH deck or something. But, yeah, that's really about all the big things I've gotten recently.
I'm up in the air currently. I talked about this in the last cast, but I'm in the position, like, this is, kids just don't do this, but I really want to have full beta everything. Like, I'm going to go, I know at some point in my life I'm going to get beta power, beta duels and everything. So, right now, I've talked to a couple of retailers. I talked to a couple this week about trading basically the bulk of my collection, apart from all the altars and like personal stuff, in for an alpha or beta Lotus, just to kind of start over and, you know, kind of go crazy. I'm not exactly sure. I don't know how the value is going to add up. There's a GP Vancouver, which is about 3 hours north of where I live. I may go up there and try to make a deal with somebody, but yeah, I mean, we'll see. I don't know. I want to do expeditions. I want to do beta stuff. But, you know, I think ever since the holidays, I've kind of just been put on pause, just, you know, living life, doing some stuff. But
right.
We'll see. I don't know. Beta duels for sure. But right now, I think I haven't decided, but I may go up and trade everything I have for a beta Lotus and kind of start over again. Because at the same time, like you said, people like seeing stuff like that. One of my favorite cube memories is one of the first times I cubed a paper cube. There's a guy in my local area who has a fully foil powered cube with real power and, you know, Mishra's workshops and all kinds of crazy stuff. That's one of the places I got inspiration for pimping. But I remember opening up the pack, like you just said, and it was a Imperial, like, you know, a Portal 3 Kingdoms English Imperial Seal next to a beta Mox Emerald next to, you know, a foil Jite next to a beta Volcanic Island, stuff like that. And people like seeing that stuff. It's, you know, I'm not going to argue whether it's responsible or not financially, but it's cool. It's a really nice experience. And, you know, like to quote Drew from last week, if anything, I think cube is just an expression of yourself. it's something that I take pride in. Like you said, your friend Jans, I also do cube. Like last night, I was on Cube Tutor for 3 hours up until 1 a.m. just relabeling everything. There's a couple cards I don't have. There's a couple choices that I'm not sure if I want to make, and just taking some stuff out, taking some stuff in. And you know, at the end of the day, I want my drafters to have a fun time. I want to be able to hang out with all my friends and, you know, sit in the living room and just drink a couple beers and have fun. So playing the Beta Lotus and stuff, there's no point in, like, I would like to have these cards, but if I'm going to have them, I want to play with them. And at the same time, all my friends like seeing, they don't, you know, they play EDH, but they know that, like, when we go to Cube, we're playing with power and we're playing with all the fun stuff. And that's just, you know, feedback that I've got over the past couple of years, and it's something that I enjoy. So it's awesome.
You're right, man. First of all, I think that if you want to be financially responsible, you probably should just turn around and walk away from Magic. That's just the ultimate advice, you know. That aside, dude, you're right. It's like, I guess to answer your question earlier, like one of my favorite memories, and it's a recurring memory, every single time we sit down to open to draft Cube and we open our first pack, undoubtedly someone is going to say like, this pack is ridiculous. And then everyone will say like, oh my God, this pack is ridiculous. Cause it's always going to be ridiculous. It's always going to be good. You know, no one's ever dissatisfied when they open a pack, which is so sick.
Yeah. Just to spin off that really quickly. I remember my last Cube draft, I had played with, the majority of my Cube right now is proxied only because I had traded up recently into like an Ancestral and stuff, but I put in real power, and I remember a cuber, one of my friends who he's only cubed once and he hasn't played in a really long time. So he opened up a pack, and his first pack was with a Lotus. He's just like, oh my gosh. So, I mean, those, you know, initial expressions from everyone just kind of makes it worth it to me. So it's fun.
Conversely, we had a draft the other night and we needed a couple extra. So one of the guys brought two friends that we knew, you know, they play standard and they draft sometimes, draft regular standard stuff. And one of the guys that was with us was a level two judge. He's currently banned or suspended. But besides that, so like he was to his left were the two newbies, right? So it's pack two, and like everybody's seen two packs, and then so we're going to the third pack. And all of a sudden his eyes just actually roll back in his head. And he just looked to his left and just shook his head. And he looked at me and he just flashes me Soul Ring. And I'm like, what? Oh, how is that possible? Yeah. It's like, I'm seriously considering like putting something inside the sleeve in between the perfect fit and just be like, this you pick first. Yeah, or like, exactly. Do not pass. If or something you, like that. I don't know.
If you pay attention to Milo's holiday cube, his Soul Ring has Mark Teden wrote first pick with like three exclamation marks on it. It's just really funny.
That's so brilliant. That's so brilliant. That's so good.
But those memories just kind of remind me of when I first started playing Magic, when, you know, you're all your friends are together opening packs and the one guy opens the Planeswalker and, you know, everyone just like rushes him around the table. It's like, oh my gosh. Ah.
Yeah. Yep.
Those are the memories that I get. And same thing, you know, when people first draft my cube and they see the Lotus, they see the Ancestral or the Full Arm Mutavault and Foil Jace and all those crazy stuff, they're just like, holy cow. And it's just fun. You know, even stuff like that, that may not be the best cards to draft and stuff like Mutavault, it's just cool to have it in your deck. So when you draw it, it's like, holy cow, you know, I'd rather experience this than actual, you know, win the draft because I'm having more fun. Yeah, so. You know, amazing cube memories. These are some of my favorite things in Magic. But on top of that, we could talk about altars for the longest time. My Starry Night altar by Eric Klug has gotten more wows than anything I've
yet. Dude, I can only imagine. Oh, man.
I actually have a video coming.
I don't think I've seen that.
I will, send you a link.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, I will, it's amazing. You know, I commissioned Eric Klug a couple months ago to do it, and, it was worth every single penny. I'm going to have him do more altars. It's an amazing, the detail, the fine print is absurd. It's just utterly amazing. And every time someone sees it, they're just like, was this a painting? Like, is this not like printed? So it's cool. I like having stuff like that. It's just really fun.
Yeah. The wow factor is amazing, dude. And he's a wizard. Like I can't wrap my head around his talent, you know?
Some of the things we were just scrolling through his pictures like on Facebook and different things that won the drafts, and he's got this, I think it's a mana drain, and just there's so many little squares or diamonds or whatever like over this guy. It's just so detailed. And you're like, he did that with a brush or something to that effect.
Yeah.
It's like, how is that even possible? But, is funny. One of the, I don't have as many altars that I'd like. I'm working on getting some more, but one of the ones I actually got from a guy that was taking apart his cube, which, you know, sad for him, but I got some good stuff out of it. it was a full memory jar that had been altered into full art. And like wow. The way the paint is on it, like it looks shiny as well. It's really, really weird.
Whoa. Okay, cool.
But like I love seeing that card, except for the fact that one of my opponents killed me with it because I only had 6 cards left in my library last week.
Oh, no.
He cast it, and I knew how many cards I had because I don't know, because he had brain freezed me for like 12 or something. I'm like, well, that's not going to get it. And then all of a sudden he just cast Memory Jar, and he's sitting there and he's tanking, and I'm like, maybe he doesn't see it.
Right,
and he went to tap mana, and he goes, wait, how many cards do you have? I was like, damn it.
Oh, damn it. And yet another interaction with Memory Jar that maybe you have not foreseen, you know?
Yeah, so, I mean, Cube can be everything from, you know, a spiky player's competitive format in which they want 360 of the most powerful cards ever printed to something that I would say most of us are most interested in, which is just an environment where we can have fun, you know, have that slight wow factor, it'd still be a little competitive, but overall just enjoy the time. So the games are nice and long. We enjoy everyone's, you know, just hanging out and stuff. And yeah, that's basically what Cube means to me. I, you know, at some point in my life, I'm not going to be able to play Magic every single day again. You know, as soon as school is done, you know, I'm planning on going to grad school, but after that, it's not feasible for me to go every single weekend and play at FNM or go and, you know, open packs. But if I still have a cube, maybe a couple times a year I can hang out with my friends and kind of relive those memories. And that's another reason why some of the alters I'm getting are some of the old video, pardon me, the old video game stuff like Final Fantasy. So when I play a, referencing White Wolf's cube, when I play a, what is it called? The level up one guy, the white one drop that levels up. What is it called?
Student of Warfare.
Yeah, Student of Warfare, and it's Cloud from Final Fantasy VII. I get the flashback from playing when I was 10 years old to, you know, the board state and its relevance to Magic. And, you know, it just goes on and on, and having those, pardon me, having those layers of creativity and complexity in a way that isn't disruptive to someone's, to someone learning the environment is something that I aim for. And I think it's, you know, one of the best things and one of the best experiences that I've definitely had in Magic.
Yeah, yep, verbatim. And also, like, you can't underestimate the fact that Cube is going to make you a better Magic player. I mean, it's assuming you're playing with pretty decent cards, it's going to be hard to win your games because all the cards are good. And, you know, having to build decks on the fly, having to spot all those interactions, like, you're going to get better at Magic from playing Cube. Mm-hmm. Okay, I guess I had a question for both of you Cube Masters. I'm starting to build a cube, and from the very beginning, what would your advice be in terms of like starting to build with a collection that you have on the side, with the intent of making a functional limited environment? Like, what is the blend between I want to play Field Marshal, I want to play Jace Beleriand, I want to play all these cards that I have stacked in my room, versus, you know, just building a functional cube? Obviously it takes some testing and it takes some research, looking through like Cube Tutor and whatnot. But on my side, never having actually played any of these cubes that I'm looking at and just seeing like a big long list of cards and card names, it's hard to see all those tiny little interactions that we've talked about earlier on the cast. So yeah, basically cube building 101 from your guys' experiences for me, because that'd be super awesome to hear.
Yeah, so I think there's two ways to approach this. I had the same exact questions, you know, when I was first building a cube. The thing that I've discovered which makes it easier is probably just taking a list that you like and, you know, proxying it or trying it out and seeing, you know, what elements of that list that you like the most, and then kind of changing in cards that you don't understand or your playgroup doesn't like. Because at the end of the day, like I had said earlier, there are cards in every list that are specifically for your playgroup. So you your cube may want to run Chromanticore because you like Chromanticore, or you may want a couple other Eldrazi because someone in your playgroup really enjoys Eldrazi, but someone else's playgroup must or may really, really like aggro. And one of the things that, like I said before, I had cards like Upheaval and Burning of Xing Yi in the original list that I had copied, and I didn't know what they did. And part of it was because I just wasn't familiar with the card pool, but the other part of it was that they just weren't for my playgroup. Some of the cards, like, once again, Moat, Burning, Upheaval, where the skill cap was so high that us as players were not quite there yet. And, you know, as you continue to draft, you will only become better at playing Magic, and, you know, you can kind of go from there. And the other way to do it, which I've seen, which is pretty common, is just kind of starting a cube and putting a bunch of cards together and going. The only difficulty with that is there's, you know, your level of balance is going to be all over the place, so white may not be as strong only because there's a lot of interactions that you possibly may not see, or the colors may not be balanced in terms of overall archetype and stuff, because it takes a lot of work to do all these things, and that's the reason so many cube owners are so meticulous with their card choices, is because each individual card has to usually transition to two or three different roles in the cube. And, you know, many people don't find out until a couple months later that, you know, some of the choices that they made may not be may not be the best decisions for their environment. So that's at least what I came to conclusion with. What do you think, Drew?
Well, one of the good things that we have now that we didn't have when I started was Cube Tutor. You know, I actually took I'd go to the Wizards homepage and went to the first Magic Online cube, and I basically just printed it off and then checked and saw what I had. And there's a couple of cards I was like, this card's horrible, or I don't know why this is in here. I just kind of went from that. I saw what I had, and I kind of proxied up some, and then made substitutions, something that I felt was pretty close, or maybe even better, or just different, I guess. For example, one of the cards that I've never put in, because I didn't like the way it worked, seemed like, was a Skrullrak, because it's a great card, but at the time in my cube, I didn't have all 10 fetch lands, and I just didn't have enough ways to shuffle, and I felt like I was brainstorm locked. I was just locked out a lot, and then it took a lot of time to play correctly, so I didn't put that in. I've never went back and changed it, but, like you're saying, you want to make sure you kind of get more of a balance. So, with Cube Tutor, what you can do is they have a list of the average cubes, and they've got both powered and unpowered. You can compare those two lists on there, or, you know, just by looking at them yourself and see which ones make it in both. And you definitely want any of those that you have, you want to try and include those and just try and get, close to the same number of, red one drops or blue instants and just stuff like that. Of course, you want to tutor it to your own personal taste, but if you really can't have too many white O-ring effects starting off, within your 360 or whatever you're going to run. You definitely want to make sure you have these certain just core types of cards, even if it's not the exact card. Like, say, if you just don't have a Faith Fetters lying around, well, you've got Journey to Nowhere. Well, it's not the same card, but it fills a similar role. So, you start off with what you have and just work towards what would make it better, I guess.
One of the, if I was to give one piece of advice, and if you're just take one thing, is that everything needs to be catered towards your playgroup, because there are certain cards that I think are really good that my playgroup just doesn't like, and there's certain cards that my playgroup really enjoys that I hate. I cannot play Molten Tail Masticore or Masticore. I think they're terrible, but I've lost to them so many different times. It's just, it has to be in there. The same thing with a lot of people dislike Mana Tithe in my cube. I'm like, no, the white deck really likes this card, and then you blow them out with Mana Tithe. And they're like, okay, fine, it's fine. But, just playing, whether making your own list or finding a list, just playing and getting feedback from your drafters. Like you said, your friend Jans has you write down the deck list to see, what you liked, how did it go, and then what cards were finally drafted statistically at the end. So, a combination of everything, I think, is the most important. But at the end of the day, you're drafting with friends and you're drafting to have a good time. So, have some fun.
I like that. I have another quick question for both of you. Is there a cube on Cube Tutor that you just geek out on that you would love to play or love to build, but you know you won't or you can't? You know, like, is there someone's cube out there that you just think is super wonky or super ridiculous and you'd love to give it a go?
Mine would probably be the Magic Box cube. That's TSG's cube. Now there's some that, like, definitely there's some that are got better alters and stuff, but you know, he's got beta power in it, and you know, there's just a bunch of cool cards in there. I've got a lot of them, but just I would like to play that cube at some point because they bring it to some of the really, really big events, and occasionally people cube with it, so that would be it.
Yeah, my choice would either be, if I wanted a super balanced environment, I'd either pick White Wolf's. He has been a guest on our show before, and I think he has, like, he just passed 1 million views on MTG Salvation in the cube thread forum. And then Ben's cube is amazing. And then there's also a cube recently posted on Reddit that was a colorless cube. And I was like, oh, you know, some of these themed cubes are kind of off, but this one seems really legit. So.
Yeah, cool. Okay.
Anyway, I know we've had some fun talking down here, but let's just kind of. Jesus Christ, I'm so terrible.
Okay, just real dude, of you just saying that, please.
Maybe we'll see. Anyway, to bring things to an end here, I kind of want to talk. You know, we talked a little bit about your YouTube channel. We've talked a little bit about Cube. We talked a little bit about Magic, but you know. I know that you have other channels, like, for example, you have a guitar channel that kind of talks about music, and, you know, where do you see yourself in the future in terms of creativity, just out of curiosity, and you know, where do you see, I guess that's it.
Yeah, dude, actually, one of the best parts about moving to Austin is just that there's so much music here, both to see and to listen to, but also there's a ton of musicians. And I lucked out because I met a couple of musicians that I'm playing music with regularly. So actually, the music channel is what brought me to YouTube way back in the day. And that was an easy transition to go from, like, YouTubing guitar stuff and guitar covers and my own music to Magic. So I'm definitely trying to keep that going. I always play. I don't make enough music videos as I'd like, but music is like the ultimate staple. That's something that'll never ever leave. So I've been playing a ton of music. Like I said, with my EDH playgroup, we've actually expanded to not only just playing Magic, but playing a bunch of board games recently. And I've learned like 10 new board games, and I'm having a blast with them. We've also started up some Smash, which I've always been really terrible at. So I'm pretty convicted this year to get better at Smash. Mm-hmm. So that's been really kick ass. Like, I feel like I've met a ton of people here. Grad school has been awesome. Just 10 out of 10. It feels like I'm living the dream. It's about to start up again, and I've kind of gotten too comfortable with, like, having nothing to do. So I'm a little tentative to, to go back to, like, spending 14 hours on campus every day, but it's a good life. It's a really fun lifestyle. So I'm excited about that. Like I said, it just feels like I'm living the dream lately, you know?
Mm-hmm. Nice. And our closing question, what is your favorite card to draft and why?
I think what I said earlier, Mold Drifter has to be up there. Like, I think Mold Drifter is one of the most just, you know, it's not a super flashy card, but every time, this is another card that Jan thinks is just 10 out of 10, perfect design, wonderful card, gorgeous artwork, irreplaceable artwork, in my opinion. Like, that card in foil is, like, the epitome of Magic to me, you know? Something about Mold Drifter, man, it fits all the shoes. Like, it's such a good card, you know? It's such a great creature. In so many decks, I think I'm always hesitant, and now I'm kind of like akin to it. You know, I've kind of grown a fascination towards Mold Drifter, so I don't think I'll ever pass it. Mm-hmm. When I read that question, that was like the first thing that came to mind. I think that is just going to have to be my answer, man. That's probably the first card in my cube, you know? My cube right now has one card, and it's Mold Drifter.
Well, then your cube has got all the value, because that's all that card is just value. Like, worst case, you draw two cards, which is it. That good stuff.
I think so too, man. I like the sound of that.
Yeah, I actually want to get a link to your Brago list. I'm really want to make a blink deck because like Venzer's like probably one of my favorite cards of all time, and I love Brago, and just like you said, blinking Moldrifter. That just that sounds like so much fun. Like I can't imagine that not being good.
You know what's best about that is you turn four Brago and then you turn five Moldrifter. And you don't evoke it. You just keep it as a creature, of course. And then you swing with Brago. So you're drawing four cards on turn five. And you still have a 2/2 flyer to boot. So, yeah, man. The Brago deck is really saucy. Another aspect of the Brago deck that I love is that that deck is going to be basically nothing to pimp out. Because you're just playing a bunch of just random, terrible rares that have semi-good enter-the-battlefield effects but were overcosted. The best part about Brago is that, you know, all these cards were designed with that enter the battlefield effect to happen exactly one time, but you just get to abuse that. So you're running like the Primordials, you're running, like I said, Moldrifter, who at like a foil is like $2.50 or whatever. Yeah, it's a blast. It's my favorite EDH deck by far. So I will happily link that to you, man.
Sounds good. Appreciate it.
Nice. So coming to a conclusion here, our guest tonight was the Magic Man Sam. Twitters, YouTubes, the like, where can people find you if they want to find more of your content?
Yes, sir. I am the Magic Man Sam on YouTube. Twitter is easy. I am at the Magic Man Sam 3 because apparently there's a Magic Man Sam out there. I need to meet this dude. He's an imposter. and that's where I am. Of course, links to other places, Facebook and Instagram and stuff, can be found through there. So we'll just keep it simple with those.
And Drew, where can they find you?
You can find me on YouTube, Quad Nines. That's QUAD, the number 9, and S. Or on Twitter, Quad Nines, but it's all spelled out.
Nice. And my name is Zakil. You can find me on Twitter at Zakil Gordon or on YouTube at Merfolk Magic. So this has been another episode of What's in the Box. We'd like to say thank you for the Magic Man Sam for coming on, as well as all of the listeners out there who are tuning in every week. And we will see you next time. Thank you so much.